Okay. So tonight, I think my plan is to talk about the distinction among meditation types. And provide a little bit of theory about the meditation technique that I teach. And a little bit of propaganda as to why I think you should practice it. A question?
It's the same one from the video, right?
Same one from the video.
Okay.
So this is my sales pitch. So let's cut right to the heart. I'm going to cut right to the heart, and then I'm going to back off, zoom out, and then slowly make my way there. Okay. The meditation that we teach, that I teach, is one way of putting it, what we were just talking about with Neelam, is to free ourselves from our reactivity, our tendency to react to things. And we don't mean like to react when someone throws a tennis ball at your head. We mean react when someone pushes your buttons. Our tendency to create and to become entangled in a situation. So, like, if I yell at you, it's only sound at your ear. That's how it starts. It starts with sound in your ear. It's up to you if you're going to get caught up in that. Just like if I bring you a gift, it's up to you if you take it. But once you've taken it, it's yours. Your problem. Our meditation, the idea is to, the purpose is to free you from this, from the need to react. And in fact, not just the need to react so then you can choose to react, but to actually simplify your reactions to things. Simplify them down to the point where you're no longer reacting, you're merely interacting. And the distinction is, rather than making 10 things out of one, you come to a state of being that is one to one. Meaning, whatever it is, that's how you see it. Not it is one, it is A, but you think it, you see it as A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Meaning, it's good, or it's bad, or it's me, or it's mine, or it's a problem, or... A cause for worry, a cause for fear, a cause for doubt, a cause for confusion, and so on. So the meditation, how it feels, is like the universal solvent. Just like water. When you have some dirt or grime or like when you're eating cotton candy and your hands get all sticky. And all you do is you pour water over it and it dissolves the material, and there's no more stickiness. So the mind that is full of heat and full of attachment and full of knots and tangles, a big mess in the mind, when you open up your mind and you look at it, so when you sit down and meditate, it's like a big mess of cotton candy, all sticky and like wading through cotton candy. Only it's not sweet like cotton candy. Mind is often very sticky, but not in a good way. And so when you practice meditation, it's not about closing it up and look in my mind at, oh, problem, and pushing it away. It's about actually cleaning. It's like you go into your washroom, your bathroom, and you see that the floor is, there's mold growing on the walls, and maybe there's something gross in the corner, I don't know what it is. And we actually plug our nose, get in there and clean the bathroom. Dissolve all the dirt and the grime, and then you have a clean mind. You have a mind that is no longer reactive, no longer slave to its desires and aversions, and slave to its habits. This is the understanding I want you to get. The problem with meditation is even the word meditation doesn't come from Buddhism. The word meditation is, as far as I know, is something that they use to describe the activity of a philosopher who sits down and thinks about something. Like we have Descartes, had a book called The Meditations. Pretty sure he didn't sit cross-legged and watch his breath. He was a nasty sort of fellow, if what I've heard is correct. Apparently he nailed I think it's hearsay, I don't know that there's any proof that he actually did this, but they say he nailed his dog to the table, a live dog, and cut it open alive. And just to marvel at how amazing was God's creation, that he could mimic human life in beings that had no soul. So this was a mimic of a human being who actually could feel pain. It was amazing how he could make it look like the dog was actually feeling pain. apocryphal, I think is that the word? Apocryphal. Uncertain origin. Not sure if it actually happened, but at any rate, doesn't sound like he was a meditator in the sense that we use the word. Sorry to give you all the visual, the image, but again, this is a good example. You see how reactive the mind is? How did you react to that? Cringe. It causes suffering to hear that. And so we're still susceptible to these states. Now, if you're mindful during that time, if you watch how your mind reacts to it, you can become at peace. You can even be at peace if it happens to you. This is the extreme case. Anyway, we'll get to that. The point I'm making here is, meditation means different things to different people. Hugely, vastly, widely, crazily different things to different people. I talked with a woman today, her idea of meditation, right away I knew she came, and this is the problem with when you meet new people, is she didn't even have an idea of who I was, I don't think, but she heard someone teaching meditation, and so she came to me, and this is always, it's kind of like a, what do you call one of those grab bags where you don't know what you're going to get, like a box of chocolates. But the thing about chocolates is they're all sweet. Even the coconut ones are not so bad. Even the nutty ones, even the fruity ones. They're still sweet. She was a very sweet person. But her idea of meditation was all about God and following her path. And I said, so what is your path? And it was, I can't quite remember, but I kind of cringed at first. And I said, oh, what do I do with this? Because it wasn't judgmental. It was just, this isn't what I teach. But I was mindful of my reactions. And I sat and I listened and I nodded when appropriate. And I gave her the time to I listened to what she was saying. A lot about belief. And then I explained to her the differences, and in the end she was ecstatic. Never thought of such a thing. You know, I gave reasons and arguments, and so that's kind of what I'd like to hope to do today. You don't have to be convinced by what I say, but at least you should understand clearly what I teach. Because it's the worst thing I run into. People say, oh yes, I meditate. And it's kind of a meaningless thing for me to hear, because it could mean anything. Hopefully not anything to do with nailing dogs to tables. In Buddhism, we make it simple, though. We narrow meditation down to two types. And so we can fit pretty much any wholesome meditation into these two types. Unwholesome meditations do not fall into these types, like premeditated murder, for example. Not in these two categories. My father, I hope he doesn't listen to this. Anyway, we joked about it. My father, in trying to come to terms, obviously we have different approaches to life, but in trying to come to terms with each other, he said, well, you know, when I hunt and I'm sitting up in my tree stand, I feel it's very meditative. I can attest to that fact. I used to hunt with him, and I remember sitting up in the tree with my crossbow, and a bird landed right above my head. It was like right here, very close, just a little bird. I couldn't believe, I'd never seen such a thing. And here I am, undertaking the most violent act possible, and it's the most peaceful situation, the bird above my head, and you know, the sounds of the forest. And then out came the deer, and they came to the tree that I was sitting in, right here, and started chewing on the cedar boughs, or the cedar leaves. They're not leaves, but the greenery. Just looking into my eyes, this mother deer. And so when he said this, I said, yeah, it's just too bad about the murder that takes place afterwards. Kind of like premeditated murder, literally. And so that doesn't fall into the realm of wholesome. So you see, meditation can be unwholesome. If you're meditating on killing, because the universal element of meditation, the common element of meditation is concentration. But you can concentrate on anything. You can concentrate on violence. But it actually disrupts your mind. It disrupts your peace of mind. Disrupts your cohesion of mind, you see, because no one wants to die. None of us want to die. And yet here we are inflicting this on other beings. So there's a dissonance. That seems just superstitious, really. If you told a scientist this, they think you're there's no science behind that. But in fact, there is science behind it. When I first went to kill a deer, the only time I ever killed such a large animal, I think, my whole body shook. And I had no qualms about killing. I'd never thought that it was a bad thing before, but I could barely pull the trigger. And I didn't know why. I had no clue why it was. No sense that it was wrong what I was doing. Afterwards, we found the deer. We brought it back. We cut it up. And I cried. Again, not even really understanding why. This is why karma, they say karma, you can't escape your karma. It's an intrinsic part of the universe. It's not some judge sitting up on high, but it's the way the world works. We're not islands. No man is an island. Well, the meaning behind that is we're interconnected with everything. You pull the one strand of the spider's web, the whole thing vibrates. We are here we are a part. Even our bodies are a part of the physical world. How we treat our bodies is going to affect the rest of the world. How we use our bodies. So, but within the realm of wholesomeness, there are two kinds of meditation. One we call tranquility meditation, because its primary goal is to calm the mind. And the other we call insight meditation, because its primary goal is to create clear vision of reality, of the way things are. And these two types of meditation clearly exist in the world. There are certain types of meditation that provide you with intense states of tranquility, calm, peace, strength of mind, fortitude of mind. But don't lead you to understand about yourself and the world around you. These ones, another word for them is transcendental meditation, so-called because they take you out of the situation. Now, I have to say, 99% of meditation in the world is this type. At least, maybe more. 9 times out of 10, if someone tells you they're practicing meditation, you can be sure they're, and it's not the bad kind of, wrong meditation, that they're practicing this one. Because it's what we want anyway. When you have a problem, what is the answer? Get away from it. Run away from it. Fight or flight. Either way, remove the problem. Remove your proximity to the problem, either by kicking it out or by getting out yourself. This we call, at best, tranquility, because it removes you from the problem. It separates you from the problem. No matter how long it lasts, that problem is always going to be a problem for you, because you've learned nothing about it. It's always going to be something you have to run away from. No matter how long it lasts, you can enter into these states and go to become a Brahma. And you can be a Brahma for millions and billions of years, watch the Big Bang and the Big Crunch again and again. Eventually, that problem is going to come back and bite you in the rear end. Because infinity is, you know, it's not just a long, long time. It means, really, it's going to happen again. And the more of these problems you have, and the more used you are to running away from them, the less peace, the less, in the end, the less happiness and the less peace you have. So I cast it in a negative light. It's not negative, it's a great thing, but it has limitations. Any meditation that takes you to a state, a specific state of peace and calm, where none of your problems exist, that we call tranquility meditation. These meditations exist. The other type of meditation, insight meditation, may not make you calm. But it will teach you about your problems. That's what it promises to do. Question is, do such meditations exist? Yes. There are meditations that are hell to sit through. No fun at all. But that's because they put you right in your problem and they force you to learn the lesson in regards to that problem. Why does this make you suffer? What is wrong with the way you react to this problem? The reason this works and doesn't just torture you, the reason why it actually has some benefit is because of the way the mind works. The mind works a lot like a small child. Well, or you can see how this works if you watch a small child, because it's exactly what they're doing. They're gaining experience. If you tell the child a million times, don't play with fire, maybe it believes you, but it will never become afraid of fire. It will never truly understand what it means to touch fire until one day it touches the fire and it knows, oh yes, fire is hot, it hurts. Not much fun to touch. And yet as we grow older, we lose sight of this. And instead of trying to understand our problems, trying to experience, we start to take shortcuts, just shoving the problem under the rug, maybe finding ways to make tricks, you know, shortcuts and tricks that allow us to avoid our problems. When you have a headache, take a pill, take a painkiller. If you have a backache, get a massage. If you have a stomach ache, take Tums, or whatever, Pepto-Bismol. All the way until if you're depressed, you take this medication. If you are anxious, you take that medication. Until finally, we get so caught up in this that the slightest little discomfort and We have to find a way to avoid, a way to chase it away. And so, this is how we come to meditation. We come to meditation thinking, maybe this is the way. Maybe this one will last forever, so I'll never have to experience it. And according to Buddhism, this is really the wrong way to look at meditation. It's a limited way. Limited reason. Limited understanding. Because it's not permanent. Nothing is anything that arises ceases. It's the law of what some kind of law of thermodynamics maybe. It's only as powerful as the effort that's put into it. What goes up must come down. So what you create has to eventually dissolve. The power is only, the power of creation is only temporary. But the power of wisdom is quite different. Because if I understand this problem, right, if I know how to, not even know how to react, but if I understand truly and completely understand the disadvantages in, say, getting angry, then when the opportunity to get angry comes up, I don't know why I would ever get angry. I have no thought of using that as a response. And so we take a shortcut around this and try to just tell ourselves that it's wrong. We know that it's wrong. We know that anger is not good. It's not good that I fight with my relatives, with my friends. It's not good that I worry about or stress about my situation, my job, my family, my possessions. It's not good that I'm addicted to this or that, cotton candy, cheesecake. It's not a good thing. I know it's not. And we think I'll just tell myself, and that is equivalent to knowing it. You see, we mistake that for real knowledge. Because ask anyone, cheesecake is wonderful. You know? Ask anyone. You really, deep down, you know it's wrong. You know it's wrong to indulge in it. But you don't really know. Deep down your mind says, come on, it's good, it's wonderful. And the same with anger, the same with all of our emotions. Worry, you know, we were just talking, you don't really know it's wrong. With worry, for example, you're saying, maybe you know you're killing yourself, but you still believe somehow you have to worry. If I don't worry, it's like you don't care. You say, if you don't stress over your problems, it's as though you don't care about your responsibilities. So, all sorts of excuses. But at any one of these, the point is that we still misunderstand it. We still misunderstand the situation to the extent that we think that something that causes us suffering will bring us happiness. Okay, so this thing will bring us suffering, definitely. We still, deep down, are of the wrong, have the wrong idea that it's going to bring us happiness, no matter what we tell ourselves. And this is what leads to guilt, repression, self-hatred, just not knowing how to fix the problem. So we hate ourselves for it, rather than cultivating. You see, you have to cultivate a deeper kind of understanding. And this is what we need to do. This is the solvent. The universal solvent is actually wisdom, understanding. Because the magic of it is, which it seems, this when I teach this meditation, people are like, I can't believe it's that simple. It sounds like one of these, maybe one of these dime, what do you call, kind of Oprah philosophies. I don't know, Oprah's actually nothing against Oprah, but you know what I'm trying to get at. One of these Maybe it's just too easy. Because, you know, eventually it gets to the point where if it was on Oprah, then it's probably not, it's not quite authentic or something like that. I don't actually know. I mean, Oprah, what's on Oprah, I don't watch Oprah, so I don't want to say bad things. But I'm more thinking like you walk down the aisle in a grocery store, right? And you get to the cashier and you see 10 new ways to lose weight, you know, improve your love life. And so then you have how to solve all your problems, how to free yourself from suffering. Buddhism 101. You have my book sitting on the shelf. No? How to meditate, a beginner's guide to peace. Only $9.99. And yet it really is, the reason it works is because it as simple as it is, it gets right to the core, right? So if you can diffuse the core, then the whole situation has no problem. So you have to, what is the key linchpin? What is it that's holding it all together? From a Buddhist point of view, it's ignorance. If any of you know about dependent origination. Basically, all it's saying is without ignorance, there's no suffering. It's a very basic teaching that doesn't tell you anything. I'm not saying, wow, you should think that's profound, but that's really what it's saying. Why? Because once you understand that fire is hot, you won't touch it. Once you really understand that anger is causing you suffering, you won't get angry. This is the claim that we make. You can see for yourself whether it's true. It happens to be, our claim is it happens to be the way the universe works. Once you understand something, it has no power over you. Once you understand that greed and your addictions are causing you suffering, really understand, deeply understand from your experience, then you lose your addictions. You have no reason. Right? You think something is going to bring you happiness. Well, once you really see that it's actually just making you more addicted to it, once you see that, you get bored of it. You lose your enchantment with it. This is like a solvent, like water, pouring water over it, washing away all the stickiness. So another neat thing to point out about this is that you don't ever have to be afraid of Buddhism. Some people are. They say Buddhism tells you not to cling to anything. But what about cheesecake? No, I mean, what about my family? What about the things I love? This is exactly the point. You will never let go of the things you love. Ever. Never, ever. Buddhism says you will never let go of the things you love. So until you see for yourself that it's no good, you don't have to worry. It's only once you see that something is causing you suffering. So go as far as you want and don't ever be afraid. This is not brainwashing, you see. It's not a dogma. It's when you really, truly, completely know that this is causing you suffering. It's so freeing. You don't have to worry. You don't have to worry whether can I accept what he's saying or not. If you know for yourself, this is what the Buddha said to the Kalamas, which everyone quotes. He said, when you know for yourself that something is wrong, let go of it. Don't take it on tradition, on religious teachings, on my teacher says it's so, I believe it to be so. You know, this is what this woman was saying, a very nice woman today. She said, I believe, several times she said, I believe this, I believe that. I said, well, you know, belief really doesn't mean anything. It has no bearing on reality. If I say, I believe that there's a unicorn under your chair, has no bearing on reality. I mean, it has the only bearing it has on reality is the reality of my own mind, that I would think up such a thing. that I would concoct such a belief. So all it's saying is, yes, you have that belief in your mind. That's what that says to me. The knowledge, when you know something, that's all that matters. You know something for yourself. So you don't have to believe anything. You don't have to choose a belief or a theory or a view. All Buddhism tells you is seek and you will find, look and you will see. Whatever you see, if it disagrees with what's in my book, throw my book out the window. I'm making a claim that this is what you will see, and you can prove or disprove me. That's what I hope. That's what Buddhism asks of you. So this, I would submit that this is the focus of the Buddha's teaching, to study yourself. Stop studying books, stop studying lectures and even your own thoughts and your own reason and logic. Start studying reality. That sounds wonderful, right? I'm not finished, because if I stop there, you'd still say, okay, sounds great, but, you know, how could you possibly study reality? And this is the brilliance of the Buddha, you see, because he figured out a way to study reality where you don't have to run away anymore. He figured out a way to understand reality, understand the truth, understand the nature of the body and the mind and existence. There are certain limitations to this. He did this by imposing certain limitations. These limitations, basically speaking, are to cut out the realm of concepts. The reason why tranquility meditation doesn't work to solve your problems is because it deals entirely with concepts. The Buddha is just a concept. The Buddha was a concept. You know, you look and you say, oh, there's the Buddha walking down the road. That's a concept in your mind. You know, if you look at the science of it, it's just light touching your eye and then something in the back of your head saying, oh yes, Buddha. Love. Love deals with beings. So it's still dealing with concepts. Love itself is real. But when you focus wishing, may this person be happy, may that person be happy, you're dealing with concepts. Because there's no person. I look at you and I say, may you be happy. May you be happy. I'm thinking of a concept, of a person. Meaning it's not the reality that I'm experiencing. It's not teaching me about reality. So all of these many different meditations that we have in Buddhism. Death, meditation on death. Well, death is still just a concept. What is real is an experience. The experience is moment to moment to moment. And so we have to even throw out the idea of ourselves. Very important. This is why people look at Buddhism, they hear it teaches non-self, and they don't quite understand. The point is, self is in the realm of concept. When I look at myself and say, oh look, here I am sitting here, here's my legs, my hands, I'm creating concepts in my mind. When I say I'm sitting here, this is just a concept. The reality is the experience of sitting, the experience of the tension in the legs and the back and the feeling against my bottom. So when we talk about understanding reality, we're limited. We're limited to what we can experience. And so this is really what the Buddha's teaching is focused on, is our own experience. We can't understand the truth about the rings around Saturn or the moons of Jupiter, even though we can say they exist. We can't use them as an object of contemplation, because our experience is limited to six things: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking. That's it. And this is why you can free yourself from suffering in all situations. This is why this meditation works, because whether you're living like a king in a palace, or whether you're a bum on the side of the road, whether you're surrounded by the sensual pleasures, or whether you're dying of cancer, in the end, it's all just seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. Remember, I had one woman, a Hindu woman, a Western woman who had converted to Hinduism and had all sorts of crazy experiences. And she would ask me about them and talk about them, how she flies through the air and visits heaven, visits hell. And I don't know if it's real. Maybe she's schizophrenic or something. But the things she was telling me, I'd never heard such things before. She said her roommate stabbed herself, and every day it was something new. Her clothes were hanging off the ceiling or something. So honestly, I mean, I'm not exactly joking when I say she may have just been hallucinating it. But what I kept saying to her is, I said, well, yes, that's still just seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. And that's our problem, is we try to find exceptions. Right? This is special. We want something special. We try to find something that's super mundane. And believe me, there is nothing. Anything that arises is still mundane. It's still just seeing. The only thing real about it for you is your experience of it. The moons of Jupiter, they're all in my mind. They may exist. It means nothing that they exist. It's meaningless to me. They only exist for me in my mind. The maximum I can ever possibly experience the moons of Jupiter is in my mind. Because when I see them, I'm just seeing light. I'm not actually seeing moons of Jupiter. So that's the limit of... But it's not a limitation of the Buddha's teaching. It's just, I think, I'm fair in saying that it's pointing out a limitation intrinsic in our exploration of reality. Yeah.
I mean, it's like a limit of the human experience.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about understanding reality. So it doesn't include understanding the reality of the moons of Jupiter or Betelgeuse or Betelgeuse or whatever. All of these far away... Betelgeuse is a solar... It's a planet somewhere or something, a sun somewhere. So there are limits to what we can truly know. And the biggest limitation is about self. Buddhism doesn't teach about self. In fact, we have to let go of the idea of self, because the building blocks of experience aren't self. They're phenomena that arise and cease. That's actually a very important part of the practice, is this letting go of the idea of self, because it lets go of ego. It stops clinging to things. It stops you from saying, oh, this is my book, my book. I'm so proud of my book. It stops me, from feeling all proud of this. Or looking at my phone and saying how happy I am to have it. And then when it breaks, or when the new one comes out, when it breaks or gets stolen. Looking at my body and scars on my body or wrinkles on my body and feeling upset about them, because I identify with them. This is me, this is mine. Or I want it to be me, I want it to be mine. I want something for myself. When you let go of self and you just see, you just live. It's still you living, But you have no concept of this is me, this is mine, of self. You get one to one. You experience as it is. I always say, this is how we think we are anyway. You all think you're just sitting here right now. And that's the way an enlightened being lives is just how we all think we live already. An enlightened being doesn't glow or float 2 inches off the floor. An enlightened being lives the way we all think we live. You think you're just sitting here, but you're not. Every moment you have, you know, maybe you're bored one moment, maybe you're thinking about cheesecake the next moment, maybe you're in pain in the legs or in the back or so on the next moment, maybe it's too hot, maybe it's too cold. All of these things are what separates us from an... That's all that separates us from enlightenment. Once we understand and let go and stop forcing, once we get back in sync with reality, in tune with reality, so our understanding and therefore our interactions with reality are in sync with the way it really is. Until we can get that, we will always have suffering. This is our the cause of our suffering. Once we do that, enlightenment. Simple, no? As I said, as I promised, the Buddha had a technique by which we should do this. He said very simply to one man, because this guy was, the Buddha was going on alms round and he didn't, you know, he couldn't take time to stop and teach him. So he said, look, I'm going on alms round. The guy said, no, listen. He kind of had this feeling that he didn't have much longer to live. He said, I don't know when I'm going to die or when you're going to die. So please just teach me short, brief, just give me something. And so the Buddha said, then train yourself this. Thus, let seeing just be seeing. Let hearing just be hearing. Let feeling just be feeling. And let thinking just be thinking. If you do this, there will be no you. There will be no yours. There will be no attachment to anything. And you will be free from suffering. So again, it's exactly what I've been trying to explain. One to one. Ditte ditta matang bhavisati. Let it be just that. It's seen, let it just be seen. In your mind, let it register just as that which is seen, just as seeing. And so the Buddha taught this way. This is what the word we call mindfulness, which is another unfortunate word because it's not exactly what the word in Pali means. It's not a bad word. Mindfulness is a good thing. It just doesn't quite capture what we mean here. The Buddha's teaching on sati, which we translate as mindfulness, means to remember that it's just seeing. To remember that it's only hearing, only feeling, only thinking, and so on. And so our ability to do that is what we mean by sati, our mindfulness. So we're getting closer. We now understand what we have to do is we have to remember. How do you remember something? You remind yourself. So the Buddha said, when you walk, remind yourself, I'm walking. When you sit, remind yourself, I'm sitting. Just remind yourself. What is it? Well, remind yourself of that. If someone's yelling at you, if your parents, listen up, this is a good one, if your parents are scolding you, you don't have to get angry or cry or anything. Just say to yourself, hearing, hearing, hearing. And it will go in one ear and out the other. You'll be totally fine with it, totally at peace. It sounds funny, but it does actually work both ways. Because when you do that, your mind will be pure. You will have no anger or frustration at what your parents are saying. And because your mind is pure, you will know how to teach them so that they stop stressing about you, so that they stop worrying about you, so that they stop all of their nonsense. Okay, that's just a joke. You do have to listen to your parents sometimes. But it's actually the best way to listen to someone, because your mind is pure and you do understand what they're saying. More than that, you get the meaning behind what they're saying. Why are they saying it? Is it coming from worry or stress? Or is it coming because they care about you, because they love you? And so sometimes it's both ways. Sometimes your parents really care for you and they really mean well and you're wrong. You're just being a bratty little child. When you say hearing and you clean your mind, and you stop being you can hear what they're saying and you realize the truth of it. And when they're worried and stressed and just, saying, oh no, you could have this and this, and be careful and so on, I'm worrying about you, don't talk to strangers. It's good advice, don't talk to strangers. But when they, when they tell you again and again and again and again and again, to the point you just get so sick of it, why stop being sick of it? Meditate, hearing, remind yourself that that's all it is. So first thing you should do, even if you want to listen to what they're saying, you should be clear of what is actually going on here. Otherwise, your mind will run away with it. It's good, it's bad, I like it, I don't like it. They're smart, they're stupid, they don't know what they're talking about. And you become judgmental. And that's why dialogue doesn't work, because we don't stand impartial. We don't deal with things based on wisdom. But now here we have a very simple technique. Just like you use Samma Arahang to focus on the Buddha or to focus on a crystal. At Dhammakaya, have you ever seen the picture of the old guy?
Yeah.
Lumpo Sot. I got a story about Lumpo Sot. Because Dhammakaya went on after him. The Dhammakaya movement is not exactly Lumpo Sot, but he was the guy who started it way back when at Wat Pak Nam. You can go and you can see his monastery still. Wat Pak Nam, it's his monastery in Bangkok.
No, I think you said that.
You can go and see it.
Okay.
I mumble. You're welcome to call me out on it if you don't understand. Please do. He went to practice with one of my teacher's teachers. One of the teachers in my tradition. Because he was a very big monk at the time. He was very high in the monastic sangha. He went with the queen, I believe. The queen of Thailand, or the queen mother, which would be the king's mother. The details may not be exact, but they went at the same time and practiced with this monk who was also very well respected, because this was a new technique that people were kind of like, could it really be that simple? It doesn't sound spiritual. And this is the thing, right? Most people would rather focus on a spiritual, mystical, magical, external object, like the Buddha. My teacher always, I was listening to his talks and he's always complaining. He's saying, people don't want to say seeing or hearing, because it's not the name of the Buddha. They think, what's... Not really something to... It doesn't really inspire faith. Like the way Buddha or Samma Arahang does. But the Buddha taught. He said, Yo Dhammang Pasati So Tathagatang Pasati. He said, who sees the Dhamma sees the Tathagata, the Buddha. And so there is something to this. And so they were hearing about this thing called Vipassana, which was kind of new to Thailand, insight meditation. And so they came. This Lumpo Sot, the guy whose picture you see in Dhammakaya, he came. And you know the practice of watching, seeing a crystal. You ever done this? Right, and the crystal goes down and on. So he was the one who came up with that. And he called it the Dhammakaya. The body of Dhamma is this crystal. I don't know how evolved his understanding of it, his concept, conceiving of it was, because it seems to have evolved. But he came to, and Lumpo Chodok, this monk who taught him, tells the story. He says he came, and so the first day he said, "Oh, so Lumpa, what do you see? How does it go? And do you see anything?" I said, "Yeah, I was sitting and I saw a room full of monks." And he said, "Oh, very good, very good." He said, "Just say to yourself, seeing, seeing." And he gave him increased his time from 30 minutes to 40 minutes or something like that. He said, "Okay, and do a little more," and gives him a more complicated exercise. And sends him back and said, "When you see it, just say seeing, seeing." Came back the next day, he said, "So how's it going?" He said, "Yeah, today I saw the Dhammakaya. I said, "Oh, what's the Dhammakaya?" "It's this beautiful, crystal, pure, like nothing you've ever seen." I said, "Oh, very good, very good. But I have to just, something to add, not wrong, but just add in there, say to yourself, seeing, seeing, seeing." He came back the next day, and this is if what he says is true. I'm just going by what the teacher said. He came back the next day, but it goes exactly with how I would expect, having practiced it. He came back the next day, and he was shaken. He said, "It disappeared. That which I thought was stable, I can't find it." He said, "I've been doing this for 60 years. These are the words that he relates. He said, "I've been doing this for 60 years and I'm getting old. I'm going to die soon. And I feel like I've gained nothing." Because what he held on to is now gone. Just because he now knows that it's impermanent. Right? When he said seeing, seeing, he was able to cut through the concept of the Dhammakaya to the visions, the experiences of vision that were arising and ceasing. And once he saw that, his concentration was cut and he couldn't get it back. And he didn't want to get it back, because this is what it changes when you see it, is it changes you. You don't want to get it back. You don't have the same attachment to it because you know it's not real. It's a concept. He wrote, and this is the proof that we have, he wrote a letter that they still have in the meditation center in Bangkok, that said, "This teaching that they teach here, this is the true teaching in line with the Buddha's teaching." He wrote something to that extent there. There's a Thai movie that really sums this, really plays this up really well. Angulimala, you know the story. If you watch the Thai version of Angulimala, it's almost exactly what I just related to you. I don't know whether they heard this story and so that's why they put it, but Angulimala has a crystal ball that he sees. It's something to gain jhana, to gain absorption. And he thinks it's permanent. And so he's deriding the Buddha. He says, "You teach that everything is impermanent, you teach that everything is suffering. So what are you saying? I'm suffering. We're all suffering. You know, you believe everything is suffering." And the Buddha said, "Well, you know, that teaching, it's a teaching tool. You know, it's meant to help you understand something." And he said, "For instance, take this." Or then he says, "Oh, I don't need to learn anything from you. I've already attained my enlightenment, and all I need to do is kill one more person, and I will be perfectly enlightened. My mind will be pure." He says, "Watch this," and he closes his eyes, and this crystal ball appears, and he focuses on this crystal. And the Buddha says, "I'd like you to contemplate this crystal, this thing that you believe is truly yourself, based on those things you've heard me teach, the impermanence. Ask yourself, is this thing really, truly permanent?" And then you watch on the screen as it flickers. And then he says, and then second, number two, I want you to ask yourself about suffering. Is this really bringing you true happiness?" And so it's a visual. I mean, we're watching a movie, right? So it's not actually going to happen that way. But you can imagine, because his life was so full of such horrific suffering from killing all these people, and he wasn't happy. And so what was really crumbling, you see it, you watch it crumble. Oh no, you watch it turn ugly. This is the visualization of suffering, but it's actually his faith and his belief in it, that he realizes that he's clinging to this desperately when his life is falling apart around him. And then non-self, he says, so ask yourself, is this really and truly self? And then he watches as it crumbles to pieces and disappears. And exactly like Lumpo Sot, he freaks out. He can't find it. He's like lost, and he's looking around, like looking for the first, like seeing for the first time. It's so, that part of the movie, I recorded it and put it up on YouTube. I cut it out and put it up on YouTube because I wanted everyone to see this. It's and I show people that movie from time to time. The rest of it's just a bunch of killing, but that part is definitely. Well, the story of Angulimala is he was a serial killer, and for whatever reason he killed 999 people, thinking that if he killed 1,000, he'd become enlightened. Well, the story, this is how the movie tells it, but I like it. It's a good telling. He says he gets this idea that if he kills 1,000 people, he'll become enlightened. So he's killed 999, and then his mother comes to find him to try and convince him to stop, because she really believes that she can find good in him. And Angulimala sees her running through the forest trying to find him, and he pulls out his bow and arrow. And in the movie, he pulls back his bow and arrow, and then suddenly there's a bright light over his shoulder, and he turns, and he sees something, this bright light. And he sees it, someone walking away, a silhouette of someone walking away. And he turns back and his mother's disappeared into the forest. So he turns and he says, okay. And he goes after this glowing figure, who is, of course, the Buddha. And the Buddha keeps running, keeps walking, you know, walking away. And Angulimala runs after him as fast as he can. And he can't catch up. And he's running through the forest, and the movie really does a good job. It's much more than that, but he starts seeing all the people he's killed, and so he's surrounded by them. The visuals are wonderful. It's really a good Buddhist movie, except for all the killing, of course. If you put aside the killing, it's a wonderful. Oh, just the movie is definitely worth watching, worth sitting through all the murder. And it's good. It's a good for testing your reactivity as well, because you see how you react to. It's not that bad. And then finally he stops, he falls to the ground, and he looks and he sees the Buddha still walking away, and he says, stop. And the Buddha says, I have stopped, Angulimala. It's you who has to stop. And Angulimala says, what are you talking about? I mean, I thought you guys had to tell the truth, and here you are basically distorting reality. You're walking, I'm standing, lying here on the ground panting. And he said, I've stopped the wheel of karma. I have stopped killing forever. I have totally laid down the rod of violence to never again harm another living being. I have stopped completely. For me, this is the end. There's no more vengeance. No more guilt. So I've stopped. You, on this path that you are on, when will you get to stop? All the guilt and self-recrimination, the cycle of vengeance will never end for you. This isn't the way to become enlightened. And then they get into the argument. About the crystal ball. And that's how he convinces him in the movie, which does it really well. So, getting back to the point, is that here we have a means, a very real, not a movie anymore, very real means of cultivating understanding of reality. And by understanding, by reality, we mean just your mundane reality, your emotions, your thoughts, your fears, your worries, your addictions, your guilt, your self-recrimination, your hate, self-hatred, self-consciousness, all of these things. Your body and your mind, you have a means of understanding it. Very simple, remind yourself. When you're walking, remind yourself, walking, walking. When you feel pain, remind yourself, pain, pain, pain. We even have, tomorrow I'll be showing you, for those of you who are here, how we do this. We start with watching the stomach, because it's objective. You don't have to wait for it to come, and you don't have to worry about any kind of reaction to it, so it's safe. Watch the stomach rising and falling. When the breath goes in, the stomach will rise. When the breath goes out, it will fall. And you just say to yourself, rising, falling, rising, falling. Continue on like that until something else arises. And so it means it's like a hunter. This is what the texts say. It's like a hunter who goes into the forest to catch a deer. They don't go running around the forest looking for the deer. They stay by the water because they know that is where the deer will come when they get thirsty. But in the same way, if you stay here in the present moment, you get to see everything your mind does. Greed arises, oh, you'll know it right away. Anger, you know it. Boredom, everything. Worry, right away you will see when it arises. You don't have to go looking for it. You don't have to go looking for your problems. How do I fix my problems? You don't have to go to find them. They'll come right now here when you're sitting here, right? I'm bored, when can we go home? Tired. I'm just picking on you because you're young and you can't fight back. You're the smallest one, so I'm not afraid of you. No. And so tomorrow I'll try to go in more depth about how we do this. Start with watching the stomach, and then we will move out to the pain. But even I've already gone through it, I've already basically told you what you have to do. Start with the stomach, then watch pain if you have pain, happiness if you feel happy. Not trying to change or get rid of it or anything or cultivate anything. Just to understand it. To try to make sense of who we are. And you really can do it. You can make sense of who you are. No matter who you are, you can. It may take many lifetimes to do it. That's okay. We have eternity. What we don't want to do is not understand ourselves. Because you drive like a... You run around like a chicken with your head cut off. If you don't use the, if you don't have the wisdom. I'm sorry, I have all these violent imagery. I actually used to see chickens with their heads cut off. My father used to kill chickens and I'd watch them. They do run around like chickens with their head cut off. No question.
So, you know, earlier you had mentioned about non-self, right?
Yes, ma'am.
But at this point in time when you were talking about understanding your feelings and
yes.
understanding what is going on in the present,
yes.
It's
called wohara. I use the words, but it's only because I mean you and not him. I don't really mean you have a self. The question of whether you have a self isn't useful, and it isn't valid. It isn't even valid, because it's outside of what can possibly be real. All that can be real is seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. Each one of those is not self. They arise and they cease. So this... It's layers, you see. Reality is layers. There's the absolute reality of the senses, and then there's layers of abstraction on top of that. The self, entities, relationships, you know. Like karma is an abstraction. Karma doesn't exist. You won't find it. But if you watch, you will see a regularity to things. So that's an abstraction. It doesn't really exist. All that exists is this experience gone, this experience gone, arising, ceasing, arising, ceasing. So that's what we mean, that's all we mean by that teaching. There's more to it, and things like it, in the sense that you cling to any of that those abstractions, including the self, including karma. If you cling to any of that, you'll never understand reality. In fact, you'll pervert your understanding of reality. Cling to self, you're only going to suffer. Because then everything is me, mine, and everything is tainted by that. You're no longer at the core of reality. So it's actually an important teaching. It's not saying just ignore it. It's not so important that you think about it. All of the teachings are not important. The importance of non-self is that you realize it. We're pointing out that you're going to realize it. It's important to point that out because we don't want to realize it. Not even in the way you may think. We want to find things that are self, in the sense of controllable, dependable, stable. This is what we want to find. We don't want to see non-self. We don't want to see impermanence. We don't want to see suffering. We don't want to see these things. So when you practice this meditation, the first thing you think is, I can't do this. You see, I'm sitting here meditating, I'm just hopeless. I'm useless at this. Why? Because my mind's in chaos, changing all the time, it's not pleasant, I can't control it, something's wrong. The first thing people think is, I'm doing it wrong. I'm hopeless at this. Or else this meditation sucks, it's a terrible technique, and there's something wrong with it. Those three things are exactly what we want you to see. Because it's the truth. It's the truth that we cannot swallow, that we cannot normally take. Anything impermanent comes up, I'm gone, out of here. Back to what is stable. I can't take this. I need something stable, permanent, dependable. Suffering arises, as I said, right away, gone. No, can't handle. Bye-bye. Non-self, I can't control. When things are out of your control, how do you feel? When knowing that your children are not listening to you, feeling trapped, feeling like you're a slave to this, or you're being controlled. Quite fearsome, quite unpleasant. And yet just happens to be the nature of reality. And so when you focus on reality, when you watch it, you come to actually become comfortable with impermanence, with things that are changing. It's really, it's something, we always say, I can't take it, and it's admitting defeat, which kind of admits the fact that you could train yourself to take it. You get this, it's just overwhelming, but theoretically, if I were good enough at dancing with life, then I could, I could, what do you call it, roll with the punches, right? And those people who can do that, those are the people who succeed in life, because they can roll with the punches. And the ability to let go and not have to control, not have to be in charge, not have to force things, not have to keep some artificial concept of how things should be. So there's absolute benefit, but it doesn't seem like it. And so tomorrow I want you to keep this in mind, if you're here or when you tried this meditation. It may not be what you're expecting. Most 9 out of 10 people, maybe 10 out of 10 people, when they start this meditation, it wasn't what they were expecting. Certainly wasn't what I was expecting. But that really is what got me hooked on it. Because you're not really expecting this to change your life. But man, it really, really, if you give it the opportunity, it changes your life like as if you're a new person entirely. Like just your whole outlook on life, it's a paradigm shift. You're looking at things in a whole new way. A good way, wonderful, absolutely perfect way. But again, because it's not brainwashing. It's, I can't believe I was so lost and ignorant before. People say, I said, it was like I was asleep. It's like I was living my life asleep, like a zombie. It's always funny when people say to me, not having any attachments. I mean, it sounds like you're just some kind of zombie. I laugh because, you know, dude, you're the zombie. Working on, you know, just slaving away, trying to cling to things that aren't making you happy. Without ever questioning, without ever stopping to contemplate and to study. To open yourself up to the universe. When you call me a zombie, you wake up. This is why enlightenment is often called awakening. The word Buddha doesn't just mean one who knows, it also means one who is awake. When you wake up, you bujjati. Bujjati means to wake up. And it's the word that becomes Buddha. It's the, conjugate it correctly, put it together correctly, that's how you get the word Buddha. So, that's enough of a talk for tonight, no? Anyone have any questions, more questions? We can sit here and discuss, but I think I've given my sales pitch. It's also going to go on the internet so people can hear it. Him first. No, you were first. First up, first serve.
So you talk about self and non-self. And first of all, absolutely true about changing life. My family is very grateful for my path in Buddhism as a much angrier person. But it also has created mental challenges. Emptiness, self being inherent, empty of any existence. And one of the things I struggle with
right. Well, you're theorizing, which is not really real, not really a part of reality. Theorizing is a human thing that we do totally based on concepts, because reality isn't about theorizing. Reality is seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking. So what you're doing there is thinking. That's what it's called. There's no sense that it's not a cell, it's not a being, you know, he's a being. But it's all conceptual. Reality is just seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. So, if you wanted to theorize from an ultimate point of view, then ultimate reality point of view, then yes, you can't kill someone. You're not killing anything. Right? Nothing's dying. No, nothing is dying, nothing, no, there's no person who's enlightened and so on. But that's not the level on which the precepts work. The precepts are theory. They're on that level of concepts. So in the same way that a person is a concept, so too the precept against killing is a concept. It's not working on ultimate, so you're mixing. You're mixing ultimate reality and conventional reality. Why the Buddha's even messing around with conventional reality is because you're so caught up in conventional reality that we've messed ourselves up so much that our minds are full of corruption, and so we do kill. We bring such intense suffering on each other because of our delusion and our ignorance and our attachment to concepts, beings. The only reason you kill someone is because you believe there's a being there. If you really and truly knew there was no being, you would never have the thought, I will kill this person. So in order to get you to the realization that there is no self, it's not really the realization, but kind of it is, only in the sense of, oh yes, all there is seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling. So to get you to the ultimate reality, we have to take you from A to Z. A to Z, you say, A to Z. And to do that, stop killing. So it's not absolute reality, but that's not what it's dealing with. Love each other. Love your neighbor. Well, my neighbor doesn't exist. What are you talking about? It's the difference, again, between concepts and reality. Those things will never lead to enlightenment, will never be enough to lead you to enlightenment. Keeping the precepts, sending love to your neighbor. And yet, the effect that they have on your mind is very real. Yes. And that effect is ultimately real. The effect that love has on your mind is quieting. That quiet will allow you to understand ultimate reality better. So love is a good thing. Conventionally, you know, it's one of the things you should be using to support your practice as you get closer to an understanding of ultimate reality. Concepts are also expressions of ultimate reality. Like you are an expression of all of your experiences put together. So if I send love to you, on some level, it is an expression of purity of my own of experience, or the purity of mind. So the Buddha, when he would send love or compassion or whatever, it's considered an expression of purity. So I mean, the Buddha talked to other people and talked about other people. He didn't deny it, but it's understood to be an expression of experience, of groups of experiences and formations, patterns of experience, and so on. It's because of where we're starting. We're starting with these sets of experiences that we call beings. And so the only way to, well, not the only way, but the way we are programmed to speak and to interact and to act. So when a Buddha lets go, when an enlightened being lets go and is no longer clinging, well, they still continue to speak and they still continue to act. But it's based on who they were. It's based on their concepts. So don't mix the two realities. The precepts are actually not the truth of morality. The truth of morality is the mind state that abstains from harming others. It abstains from anger, greed, delusion. Or else it's the guarding of the mind. So the first effort to meditate, to be mindful, to keep the mind clear, that's morality. Because it's what leads you to focus your mind. Right? If you don't have morality, your mind will be scattered. If you're not guarding, collecting the mind, keeping it, reminding it, bringing it back, coaxing it, and so on. So it's the first step. The precepts are just like fence posts to show you where you have to build your fence. They're not the fence itself. Yes. Morality is generally practiced. It's not always. It depends on the person. Sometimes, because sometimes you want to start with wisdom, which leads you to be moral, right? In a sense, we all do. You have to start with some wisdom and some understanding in order to be moral. And so wisdom leads to morality. And that's how the Eightfold Noble Path is arranged. Right? But you could say that the reason the Buddha put it that way is because he was talking to people with the wrong view. If you have right view, then you've already got that wisdom. So you go to start with morality. So when he talked about trainees, he would start with morality because they already had right view. But it's not really, in that sense, a starting. Where you start is with mindfulness. You should start with the precepts and with right view. Start with precepts and right view. Because if you're not keeping the precepts, they're fence posts. If you're outside the fence post, you're not going to. You can put up all the fences you want, the horse is gone. So start there with the precepts. If you can keep yourself, if you got the horse inside, then start building your fence. But get the horse inside first. Get your mind within the realm of basic morality and have a right view, which means, in this case, an understanding of the difference between conventional and ultimate reality. Because if you don't, mindfulness is useless. So, not useless, but you won't be able to use mindfulness to understand reality. So, if you don't get the difference, then you will always be practicing, for example, Samma Arahang. And you will never move on to focusing on your awareness on the ultimate reality of pain, or you know the four satipatthana, or the four noble truths, the five aggregates. Right? We often overlook the five aggregates, especially in our meditation. How many people do you know who meditate on the five aggregates, and yet the five aggregates are the truth of suffering. The one thing that we're supposed to study so that we can let go of and be free from attachment to. Was I done? Was there something that was... Did I finish answering?
I think I got the answer.
Right, it was about how you start. Just give me a second here to finish that off. But once you've got right view, in that sense, then you can apply mindfulness. And that mindfulness will lead you through true sila, true samadhi, and true panya. Mindfulness is like the thread that goes through the pearl necklace. It goes from one thing to the next. It leads you through the stages. That's what you need after you have right view and morality in that sense, because that will direct and focus your mindfulness. Then start with mindfulness, and that will guard your mind until you're able to see things clearly, and you focus on things, which is concentration. Once you're focused, you will see clearly, which is wisdom. Once you see clearly, you'll let go. You'll stop expecting things to be other than what they are, because you'll see they are what they are. You'll get an understanding. It is what it is.
With regards to reciting, I guess, whatever's going on in your mind, it seems to me like that could be just an awareness of what's going on versus the actual label of, you know, thinking. I mean, you could just...
You don't need to use the label, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, if that were the case, we'd all be enlightened, because we all already are aware of things. That's the point, is we're only aware of things for a very short time, and before we give rise to a clinging, this is me, this is mine. It's very subtle, but you could say, I already know that I'm sitting. Why do I need to say sitting? That's exactly why you need to say sitting, so you stop knowing the I, so you're able to just focus on the experience. Otherwise, you think it's me focusing, it's I. You can't get rid of three things: ditti, mana, tanha. You can't get rid of your views, you can't break away from these things. It's not strong enough to break away from wrong view, conceit and craving.
Well, what I mean to say is, versus the label, I mean, it seems to me that the awareness could follow the physical sensation of whatever, like pain, for example.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, when you have pain, you already know there's pain. Why do you? Are you enlightened?
Huh?
Are you enlightened?
No.
I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, but maybe you are, but. You know, because of that, you can't become enlightened. Technically, it's possible. You don't necessarily need to, but the chances of it, you try it both ways. The benefit of reminding yourself, it's not labeling, it's reminding yourself. Labeling sounds so awful. You're not labeling, you're reminding yourself. It's a reifying the true nature of it. It's also, the other thing it's doing is it's stopping you from going into detail. Because the Buddha said this, he said you become someone who doesn't grasp the detail, doesn't grasp the characteristics. Na nimitta gahi, na nubhyanjana gahi. You neither grasp the characteristics or the details of the object. It keeps you at just a bare awareness of as it is. The Buddha said this, he said, Gachanto va gachami ti bhajanati. When walking, you know, gachami, I walk, I'm walking. The commentary asked the same question you did. They said, I mean, isn't it enough to just know you're walking? He said, well, dogs know that they're walking. That's the answer. They don't become enlightened. Because it doesn't cut through self, it doesn't cut through craving. But you try it. You don't have to take my word for it. You can try both ways. It's not pleasant, but this is what I say. If you do it my way, I guarantee it will be chaotic, unpleasant, and uncontrollable. Can you say that about any other meditation? Can any other meditation brag such a thing? Very few. Yeah. And it will teach you patience. It will teach you how to deal with this. I shouldn't be so harsh because there are many different approaches and beliefs and views on what is the right meditation. I would like to say for all of you, I'm grateful that you're all practicing meditation. Again, box of chocolates. They're all sweet. Right. All right. Well, I'd like to express my appreciation for it, and I hope that you're all are able to try. That's why they call it practice. You know, we're not here because we're perfect. We're here to practice. So trying is enough, really. It's when you stop trying, that's when you fail.
The other fundamental question I have is, what is the purpose of this life? What are we here to achieve? What is there on this earth that we need to fulfill and do or complete?
That's a very bad question. Because it's outside of reality. There's nothing in the six senses that is an aggravating answer, I'm sorry, but there's nothing in the end seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. Sorry. If I had to answer, I'd say there isn't one. Reality doesn't admit of a purpose. That's a human concept. We want to make sense of things, so when it rains, we want to know why it rains. Is it because I did that funny dance? Okay, so when I know what to do if I need it to rain. Is it because I prayed to this god or that god or this tree or so on? Okay, now I know what to do. Why didn't it work? Well, it's because I wasn't faithful enough, you know. We want to ascribe meaning to things. Hollywood helps us along, of course, prescribing a meaning to everything, and the whole everything, I know everything, you said, I think, someone said to me, I know everything's going to turn out right. I think it was the other woman who came to see me again. Right, she said, I know that if I just trust, everything's going to work out right in the end. Well, that's what Hollywood tells you. It's not what reality tells you. She said, if I can just stop worrying, I think is what she said. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to rephrase that for you. if you stop worrying, things will work out all right. And it's your worry that is stopping things from turning out all right. Things won't turn out all right. If you keep worrying, things are going to turn out very, very poorly. Great, okay. So, see you tomorrow? No, won't see you tomorrow. Will I see you tomorrow?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Tomorrow, keep in touch.
Thank you.
Good night. Yes, sir.
What time is the meditation?
10 to 4. But you can come by any time. I'll be there all day until at least 4.
Okay, cool. Let's see. Kind of taking tomorrow anyway.
So right now. I think we'll do it in the house then.
No? Yeah.